One aircraft, flanks blazoned with a bizarrely stylized hummingbird, fired its chain gun. Kane heard the screams of exploding shells ripped apart a squad of his sectmen advancing in file along a pink stucco building front. Smoke gouted from beneath the other bird's stub wings. Kane invoked his solar shield and ducked, because he doubted even it could absorb a direct hit from a 57mm rocket. White flashes danced in the disk of yellow radiance he held angled upward and toward the blast. Whether high-velocity frags or merely chunks of debris, he didn't know. He was just as glad not to get hit by either. The choppers slashed overhead. The trailing ship, painted with a rampant jaguar and spilling black smoke from somewhere, continued on, curving back south toward the center of town and presumably a home base in Talokan. One of Kane's people, probably a knight with an energy weapon, had clearly tagged it. The other ship ducked behind the yellow brick warehouse. He heard shots from behind him and shouting. He half-turned so he could scan both directions along the canal side by simply swiveling his head. Foot soldiers were attacking along the canal. They looked like Talokan sectmen, grunts with their shades of gray camo shirts and trousers for armor, machine pistols, or the ubiquitous M16s held across their chests. Blaster fire crackled from his own men on the street and quayside, or ducked down among piled cargo behind the pedestal of another big crane, or from doors and alley mouths. Men in mottled gray went down, some voluntarily, diving and returning fire, others lying still and staring at the sky. Kane rapped quick orders over his command channel. His knights really were pretty sharp, and the grunt-level cop types didn't seem to resent him ordering them around. The survivors of his bodyguard squad, now nearer one handful of knights than two, had done a fine job holding the sectmen to good fire and movement patterns, keeping near cover. So the surprise Talokan infantry assault hadn't caught them dangling their parts in the breeze. Ah, but the clever bastard in the remaining gunship had notions. The chopper swayed out sideways, fired a burst from its chin gun, then let its momentum carry it behind the boom of a crane, even as Tonatio's flare seared the sky through which it had just passed. A quick radio check and glance confirmed that the chopper's fire had torn up nothing but pavement and assorted trade goods. Kane, who had learned more than he was comfortable with about Valley culinary habits in his few days here, gods had to eat as well as drink, it appeared, didn't want to speculate on what the little caviar-like globular things in goo strewed over the pavement were. The pitch of the chopper's noise changed. Kane unleashed a second blast. But the pilot had faked his move. The bolt sizzled harmlessly by, and then he swung out into clear view, unleashed a volley of rockets, and whipped behind the warehouse. Kane tried to launch a follow-up shot, and blackness crowded his vision down to a near pinpoint as a reward. He sat down, gut and cranium spinning, as screams and blasts behind him told him the rockets hadn't struck as harmlessly as the explosive bullets had. He'd already learned that he had to let those solar batteries recharge while playing with the monsters. The cagey prick pilot had Kane's men sandwiched. Shooting them up from front and rear simultaneously, he and the squaddies on foot could pick them to pieces. Long before that happened, of course, the sectmen would have broken and gone streaming away en route, proving to all, especially the TV choppers drifting high overhead, that the rebel god's power was as nothing to that of Talokan. Welcome to the PR war, Kane thought as his vision cleared and his stomach ceased its slow rolls. He'd read about it, but had little experience of it. When he was a magistrate, public relations consisted of reminding the denizens of the Tartarus pits what happened when you crossed a mag, or even looked crosswise at one. Whereas what he was fighting for now, he had been told over and again by his hosts, captors, allies, was first and foremost the hearts and minds of Tenochtitlan's fickle voters and worshippers. Screw that, he thought. Right now what I'm fighting for is my own inadequately covered ass.
Baptiste, what's your status?
I just washed a squad of foot soldiers into the canal. We've also got unfriendly wildlife coming out of some offices. I'm a little busy.
We're pretty well sandwiched over here between the Hilo gunship and some foot-mounted cold hearts. Can you lend a hand?
Love to, Kane. All you have to do is tell me what a water goddess can do about a flying machine from half a click away.
Kane crouched, keeping his sword in hand. He had to be judicious with the solar flare. He couldn't just spray and pray or he'd pass out, and this was not the time to be out of the fight. The chopper jock was smart, way too smart. He seemed to understand the limitations of the sun god's powers far too well.
Fuck. I bet Tezcatlipoca briefed his flyboys about us and what we could likely do.
Could be, Kane. And by the way...
The gunship darted into sight, up and over the warehouse. Kane brought his sword up to flash blast the Hilo, knew already it was going to trigger a volley of shrikes right on top of him, even if he did zap it successfully. As he blinked at the big blooming green balls of afterimage, He realized he had seen something long and dark flash into his field of view just before the explosion. In fact, his mental replay told him it had been streaking like an arrow right for the chopper's big engine exhaust. A missile, he realized. That meant...
First I got to fly your ass to fight some monster. Now I got to save your ass. Some god, huh?
King blinked. He was ducked down now with his solar shield on and over his head as assorted helicopter parts rained on him. He hadn't even known his comm unit got this channel.
Thanks, but who is this? Our pilot from yesterday?
Si. My name is Polchak.
I didn't know that.
Didn't bother asking. I'm just an Indian, a chauffeur, not important to a big gringo god.
I'm sorry. I'm new to this. I was distracted.
Don't shoot.
Kane radioed his bodyguard to tell his men to hold their fire on the whirlywag. A gazelle painted with the plumed serpent insignia promptly hove into view, 100 yards farther along from where the Talokan gunship Pancha had splashed was lurking. 30 or 40 enemy SecMen were still trading bullets and blasts with Tonatio's command down the street the other way. A plasma bolt seared Kane's vision and blasted a chunk out of the stained brick corner on the building right across the street from him. Some of Talokan's finest had come out to play.
Want us to send them packing?
The sun god was getting fed up with ducking and running. So Talokan would show the folk of Tenochtitlan how weak and pathetic the deities in service to the plumed serpent are? Very well. Tonatio will fill their bellies full. As the Tonatio persona rose up, so did rage, combined with a strange sensation, a keen suction hollowness like hunger. The rage took flame. Yellow fire flickered around him in a hellish halo.
No. Tonatio thanks you. You may keep watch for enemy flyers.
He was speaking Nahuatl, thinking in it too. He was no longer Kane. The pilot came back with some impertinence that Tonatio might have felt bound to punish had he noted it. He did not. It was time to take the fight to the foe. He straightened. The shield strapped to his left arm became a yellow-white sun. He charged. Bullets sought him. He ran in a quick serpentine with his legs pulsing quicker than they ever had in his life. He was a poor target for excited men whose pulses weren't slowed by the spectacle of a gigantic gold-armored figure bearing a shield of flame racing right at them with infinite aggression. They shot at him. They missed, or their bullets turned into incandescents themselves within the circle of the sun shield. The master tactician who was Kane might not exactly have been driving the machine, the killing machine he had become, but he wasn't asleep. They can't miss forever, he reminded the primal urge, the living fire that was Tonatio. The enemy skirmish line got closer fast. It seemed as if Kane could feel their muzzle blasts on the exposed skin of face, arms, and thighs. Tonatio's response to his warning was to extend his right arm and flame 3 Talokan infantrymen lying unwisely close to one another out in the middle of the street. They barely had time to scream before the sudden boiling of the moisture in their tissues blew their bodies into smoking, flaming chunks. The god's amusement was feral, his hunger ablaze. The table is set. Now we dine. He was in among the enemy troops. He split the skull of the first man he overran without breaking stride, then wheeled to chop in 2 the long blaster a second tried to swing on him from the hip. The same stroke severed the arm beneath so that the front half of the rifle, hand still clutching the foregrip, sprang away. The man reeled back, shrieking and spurting, as Kane spun the other way, whipping his hand around in a flat backhand arc. A thunk and the least tug of resistance, and a head popped free of its torso atop a geyser of scarlet. He was a whirlwind of flame and sharpened glass and blood. His sword went around and around, over and down and back around, drawing black and crimson arabesques in the air. Limbs leaped from torsos, heads sprang from necks, souls sprang from bodies, and into Kane, or the entirely inhuman creature he had become. The god Tonatio could feel the life energies of the slain flow into him, drawn into the net of blazing filaments that were his inmost being, and he exulted. Throwing down a machine pistol, a camo-clad man turned to flee. It did no good. Kane slashed his spine in 2. Blood jetted from his back and hit Kane in the face. He smiled, licked his lips, and enjoyed.
Your blood and souls are mine.
His demon rider sensed a danger, a flux of lethal energies. He swung the solar shield up and around, just in time for it to flare to nova brilliance as it absorbed the full blast of a plasma rifle. The edges of Kane's vision blackened as if charred in sudden fire. Yet this time, it wasn't because his energy was drained. The opposite, in fact. The plasma jolt all but overloaded him, came within an ace of burning out his neural circuits. But Tonatio was in control. He instantly leveled the sword, and a solar flare leaped out in light-speed response. His enemy, a tall, strapping warrior whose helmet was molded in the likeness of an eagle's head with a hooked, ferocious beak, could no more dodge a beam than Kane could. But like Kane, he could read his enemy's body language in time to anticipate the shot. He saved himself from incineration, but the front of his plasma rifle vanished into a puff of metal steam. He cast it away and snapped a lanyard-hung sword into his hand with a flick of brawny wrist. For a moment, they stood there, eyeing each other across a space little more than 2 yards in length. The Eagle Knight's eyes were like black mirrors themselves, with a face painted red on one side and white on the other. The sunshield's glare faded, died. No point burning prana to maintain it now. This was man to man, or man to god. The knight screamed a wordless raptor cry, and then threw an overhand slash at the crown of Kane's head. Tonatio stepped up with his right foot, thrusting forward his own shield with all the strength of his legs. The round shields clashed. The Eagle Knight was driven back before his stroke could land. He was good, though, and nothing daunted him. He recovered instantly and aimed a brutal follow-up cut toward the bridge of Kane's nose. Kane's shield came up at an angle, shed the whistling blow like water to his left. The Eagle Knight never tried to check the stroke, but looped it around and up for yet another overhead strike. But Kane wasn't content merely to defend. His own sword lashed out in a blow that was almost straight, like a punch, a wrist flick at the end, driving the sword with savage force. The other was good. He got his shield in the way. Kane's blow smashed it dead center. The metal-sheathed polycarbonate simply shattered. So did Radius and Ulna of the left arm strapped behind. Kane felt agony twist the other's life force before hearing the grunt, which was his only physical response. The Eagle Knight didn't cease to fight. He didn't even slow, but Kane's shield easily parried his counterstroke. His sword split the eagle's beak and the face beneath and the skull behind. The knight's eyes rolled inward as if to stare at the blade embedded between them. A trickle of blood ran down the left side of his aquiline nose. The man's life force flowed up Kane's arm and into him. The fight was done. The common troops of both sides, even the fully human knights, had ceased their firefight to watch the duel. At the outcome, the Talokan forces broke and ran, fleeing the wrath of the Lord of the Sun. Kane yanked free his sword, shed blood and brains with a snap of his wrist, then held it up in triumph. From behind, the cheers of his men flew up like a flock of startled birds.
Bravo, Sun God. But enemy flyers come. It's about to get hot down there where you are.
Thanks, Poncha. Keep them off best you can.
He was all Kane again, and poignantly aware that he had just slaughtered a brave, doomed man. So what else is new?
Everybody, time to pull back to Tlian Tlapayan.
Chochi Huitlique.
Baptiste?
I'm here! We've got choppers hitting us too, and a lot of great, big, crawly, venomous things!
Then you'd better come with us. We'll cover you as best we can.
General Absildo won't be happy!
Screw him! We can't fight every animal in the Talokan Zoo in a combined air and surface attack. Not without a plan and better deployment.
How goes it with Lord Quetzalcoatl?
The man in the silken suit was sleek, his hair slicked back from a classically handsome face, and if the line of the jaw had begun to grow a bit puffy, his enormous personal magnetism drew one's attention from the fact, as the excellence of his tailor made up for the thickening of his waist. Marakin inclined his head to the side.
A dying god. With all that both conditions imply.
The other man of consequence, both the doctor's visitors had brought aides to hover discreetly, in the room high up in the Institute's main structure, snorted.
Can you replace him?
He was a big man with a frankly big paunch, but solid-seeming within a khaki uniform shirt. The shirt collar bore stars, and the face above it was a big, dark Indian slab. They stood near a smoked glass wall looking out over the compound and ramparts across the city spread below. Little stalks of smoke sprouted here and there, marking where the morning's action had occurred. Beyond them, hazy with distance and smoke, were visible the three great central structures of Talokan, the Palacio del Parlamento, the Black House, and the Pyramid of the Gods.
Replacing him would be a most unfortunate extremity, Don Esildo.
If we restore him to his rightful place, the facilities of the Black House might well in turn restore his health and spare us such expedients. But that will depend as fully on your own efforts in Parliament, Don Hilario, as upon the excellent General Martinez's actions in the field, or those of our brave new guards.
It was a practiced gesture, and perhaps too overtly meant nothing.
A master stroke, Dr. Marroquin, to employ gringo barbarians from the semi-mythical Norte to house the essences of our ancestral deities. They are more, how would one say, readily disposable than our own people.
Dr. Marroquin smiled in return.
They are truly extraordinary individuals, not just in skill, training, and experience. At least two of them were purpose-bred to excellence. And our newest addition, though something of a feral child, nonetheless managed to win a place in their company through her own abilities.
Don Hilario performed a gracious gesture.
Of course, of course. Brave. This Tonatia of yours just ordered our forces to withdraw without consulting me.
The whitecoat suppressed a smile. He had monitored comm traffic during the battle and knew that the general had called Tonatio to demand to know by what authority he had ordered the pullback.
On what authority? Divine right, damn it. If that doesn't suit you, just wait till I get back, ram my sword up your ass to the hilt, and give you a quick plasma enema. Then we'll check the chain of command.
Dr. Marroquin still found that immoderately amusing. General Exildo Martinez wasn't incapable, and he was fanatically devoted to the cause, albeit his own interpretation, and for his own reasons. But he was also a self-inflated old horned toad, to be sure.
The Sun God's host is a man of great tactical experience, and he possesses some of the memories and abilities of Don Pedro de Alvarado, an accomplished captain in his own right. But I have little knowledge of such matters, General. You must consult him upon his return.
I will.
The door opened. A naked woman walked in. A black giant followed her like a shadow. She was small, slim, and paper white, from short-cropped crown to sole, not omitting the trim patch of hair between her slender, well-muscled thighs. A gasp rose from the aides. Don Hilario's face oscillated so wildly between outrage and lust that he put Marroquin in mind of Pinal, Huitzilopochtli's flack. It was the general who found voice first.
Young woman, what is the meaning of this? It is disrespectful.
She's not a woman, General, can't you see? She's obviously a mutie.
Oh, I'm more than that.
And as Domi walked forward, she changed. Her white skin turned black as though she were a clear vessel poured abruptly full of ink, as did her hair, everything but her eyes, which remained blood red. Small, faintly white rosettes bloomed on her glossy body like inclusions in obsidian, or the spots of a jaguar. Suddenly she moved aside in a blur, lashing out with one arm. The aide who had called her a mutie yelped in dismay and jumped back, raising a hand to his cheek. Four thin red parallel lines tilted across it, grew fat with red droplets that ran and mingled to become scarlet hatchwork.
Not a mutie. Albino. That's different. Now you've made me a goddess.
She rolled over her hands and held them up before her to reveal the black needled talons that now tipped her fingers in place of nails. Dr. Marroquin pressed hands together before his white-coated breast and bowed.
And to what do we owe the honor of your presence, divine Itza Papalotl?
Tell me what victory means here.
Domi stopped before the men and looked up at the two visitors, tiny yet defiant. Don Exildo's face, already the color of an old saddle, turned purple.
You question our judgment?
Suddenly a single claw was pressing up under his chin. He lifted his head, looking surprised.
I do what I want, fatso.
From behind came an unmistakable metallic sound as one of the general's aides hauled out his slab-sided model 1911 45 caliber hand blaster, snicking off the safety with his thumb. Before the aide could fire, a black blur flashed before his eyes. The points of his collar fluttered as if in a wind. The hand blaster fell in clattering pieces to the polished hardwood floor. Domi still had her talon poking up under the general's big jaw.
Bridget and Kane have problems being gods. They're decent people, brought up in a ville. With walls and roof and running water. Kane was a mag, but he's no cold heart. That's why he's an ex-mag. And Bridget was a librarian. But me? I'm pure outland scum. Grew up in the desert. Coyote and Hawk and the Rattlesnake make the rules. I got no problem being one of your nasty Aztec gods. Isa Papalotl and me are the same. I'm the Black Butterfly.
She dug in the talon. A single red bead appeared beneath the general's chin.
Drinking straight from your veins gives me no problems at all.
Don Hilario had recovered his professional composure. His neck hadn't been punctured.
Perhaps Don Isildo might condescend to answer the goddess's questions.
Ask.
She lowered her hand and let his head down. He refused to rub his neck. After brief hesitation, an aide bustled up and dabbed at the blood with a kerchief. Throughout all this, Grant had stood by like an idol with arms folded.
How do we know when we won and when we can go home?
But did you not know what we were doing when you agreed to undergo the conversion?
Did that for my friends, to help them. Also wanted to find out how it felt to be a goddess. Turns out I could like it too much. So answer the question.
When we restore Lord Quetzalcoatl to his rightful place in the Triumvirate, of course. When balance is brought back to Tolokan and to the valley.
She cocked a skeptical eye at him.
Balance brought back? Not after we cut Huitzilopochtli's and Tezcatlipoca's hearts out and sacrificed them to each other? Thought they were the serious bad guys here.
Don Hilario paled slightly.
Well, that would mean chaos. Anarchy. It would totally disrupt everything.
You trying to tell me you might want us to die for a tie score?
By no means. We must decisively defeat the enemy forces. It's simply that our goal is to compel their submission, not exterminate them, Lady Itza Papalotl.
I'm not a lady either, but you can call me that anyway.
Democracy must be restored. True democracy, not merely parliamentary theocracy.
Democracy, to be sure, but suitably managed. The people's very acquiescence in the sanguinary excesses of the two show they cannot be trusted with full self-government.
There must be a plebiscite. The Estados Unidos Mexicanos must rise again!
Gentlemen, this is neither the time nor place for this particular debate. Now, Lady Itza Papalotl, have your questions been satisfactorily addressed?
For now. But if you even think of screwing us...
She turned and stalked out, leaving the words hanging behind her like a guillotine blade.
Kane?
Teresa, the young hybrid woman, spoke English, the language of the científicos, scientists, scholars, and the educated middle classes. Spanish was the tongue of the common folk, and Nahuatl, the speech of the gods and their elite servants, the knights and Black House priests. The man who stood gazing out upon the lake of lights that was Tenochtitlan, and the distant wall of volcanoes casting a sullen cherry glow upon the underside of a storm front moving in from the east, turned and smiled.
Thanks for coming, Teresa.
It was the place of the morning's meeting, another of the many spaces devoted to contemplation, study, and quiet conversation dotted throughout the Institute's immense sprawl. Aside from a few amber lights glowing at the bases of planters holding tropical flora, and the light spill from outside, it was dark. She began to cross to him. Halfway, she stopped and turned. She realized that there were three people in the room. One stood at the end of a low settee placed against another floor-to-ceiling window of polarized glass, and the third lounged upon it. With a gasp, Teresa turned back toward Kane, elfin lovely features accusing. Next to him was the tall, statuesque woman with the hair of flame and eyes like the sea.
Don't blame him. We all ganged up on him and made him ask you to meet him here.
Next to her was the enormous black man with the gunfighter's mustache, who against all reason had refused the gift of Godhead when it was offered freely to him.
We just wanted a chance to talk to you without Marroquin or that floppy puppy Ernesto hovering around.
So you think I am so inconsiderable next to the doctor?
The unnaturally pale woman, no bigger than Teresa herself, with the short hair the color of sun-bleached bone and the exhibitionistic streak, rose from the couch.
Get real, chica. You're not in his league.
Domi wore a short, square-cut smock embroidered with stylized images of butterflies and jaguars, totems of the entity with which she had been imbued. Grant had persuaded her to put it on to reduce friction with the locals. She skinned the smock off over her head and tossed it aside, putting its wrinkle-resistant qualities to the test. Her nude body glowed like a pale white flame, as though with light of its own. She sat again.
That's better. We're all friends here, right?
No disrespect to you, Teresa.
But we've got an old snake of our own back home, name of Lakesh. We can't get anything over on him either.
Teresa turned to Kane. His scarred, handsome face was grave. She felt her cheeks burn with fresh outrage.
What use will you make of me, then?
Sorry if you feel I've taken advantage. Then again, just think how Baptiste and I feel about what you've done to us. We want answers, nothing else.
But we'd better get all the answers we want.
All right, ask.
Why don't you go ahead and sit down?
Teresa hesitated a moment, then did as she was bid. Kane, whom she knew as the god Tonatiuh, came and sat across from her.
You've been watching us for a while with that smoking mirror of yours.
It isn't mine.
No, your doctor pal swiped it from Tezcatlipoca when he defected.
It belongs to all the people of the valley.
Whatever. The important thing is you know plenty about us. You know our history with hybrids is not exactly pleasant. So maybe you can understand why it strikes us as important to find out just exactly what they, and lots of evidence of their technology, are doing down here in this territory, where there aren't supposed to be any.
You despise me, then?
The tall woman crossed to her. Teresa made herself look squarely at her, although she was at least as intimidated by the woman's size and striking looks as by the divine power she herself had helped confer upon her.
May I?
Of course, Lady Precious Green.
Bridget sat beside her.
We don't despise you. Neither Kane nor I are entirely happy about being kidnapped and violated, but we understand your reasons, and we have agreed to help you against a very dangerous common enemy. But there's just too much we don't know.
And in a game like the one you've pulled us into, not knowing can be lethal.
The hybrid woman sat a moment, looking down at the floor with its tiles of polished hardwood in various shades. Then she raised her head.
Very well. I will tell you what I can. You know the tale of your reunification.
Only since we were school kids.
But there is more to the story than you know, Senor Grant.
Now that's a surprise.
Don't pay any attention to him. He's in his growly bear mode.
Grr.
What you may not know is that there existed factions within the group responsible for the reunification scheme. The conspiracy of hybrids and humans that cloaked itself behind the name of Archon Directorate. The original intent truly was benign, to rescue Earth and what was left of humanity from anarchy and desolation. Only after reunification was accomplished did it become clear that there was a hard core within the Directorate whose only aim was domination.
You mean that there really were hybrids who thought of us humans as something other than livestock?
Oh yes, Lady Itzapapalotl. They believed that hybrids and humans should live and work in total harmony, as some of us who came after do still.
In short, your side lost.
Yes, and fled here.
Where they somehow hooked up with Felicidad Mendoza.
And their twin sons, Pablo and Pedro. A bitter error. Under the mirror's influence, she had already fused her identity with that of Coatlicue. And her son Pedro, elder, weaker, and more studious of the pair, had already begun to plumb the mirror's secrets with an understanding beyond his years.
So Pedro Mendoza became Tezcatlipoca?
And Pablo, of course, was invested with Huitzilopochtli. But this came later, after the mother had made common cause with the hybrid exiles.
What was the basis for all this cheerful cooperation?
Felicidad had the powers of the goddess, and had built a power base of worshippers among the survivors of the city's final destruction. But she was only one, her sons half-grown. Her status, even her survival, was far from assured. For their part, the exiles were fascinated by the phenomenon of an actual goddess, a true human, not a Danann. And she was in possession of an obvious Danann relic, or a Danann-derived one. The hybrids and humans were fugitives, fearing they might be hunted down and exterminated by those whom they themselves had helped make overlords of all North America. Alliance was the natural course for both sides.
And offered a shot at the social engineering the exiles had tried up north.
Yes, you are right.
Let me guess. They got screwed again.
See, but please, Lord Grant, you are getting ahead of the story.
Sorry.
Go ahead. And it's just Grant.
Thank you, sir. They join together, the exiles and the Nesan gods, making use of the powerful remnants of ancient technology the exiles possessed, in conjunction with the Smoking Mirror. Even as the Vills of the Nine Baronies were built in the north, so the rubble of what had been Mexico City was leveled, and the new city of Tenochtitlan was built upon it. The newcomers had trained the Mendoza twins in all the arts they knew, thinking, I suppose, to bind the boys more closely to them. Yet in the end, they were fully their mother's sons. When they entered adolescence, during the reconstruction, Coatlicue, with the full cooperation of the exile leader, Moral, and his chief scientists, Daraul and Dr. Marroquin, invested each with godhood. They became, each in accordance with his nature, the hummingbird on the left, and the deity named for the Smoking Mirror itself. But more was needed still. Even with their superhuman technology, the task of rebuilding was enormous. So were the threats they faced. Earthquakes and eruptions, marauding monsters, raiders from outside the valley. So Coatlicue raised up still more gods and goddesses with the acquiescence of the exiles. Chipetotec, the flayed god, Tlaloc, Chicomecoatl, the goddess of maize. They helped rebuild the city and to make agriculture thrive within the valley with the help of climatic change that brought unprecedented levels of rainfall and the volcanoes whose ashfalls enriched the soil.
Domi rose from the sofa, and as she did, took her aspect upon her like a glass filled suddenly with night. The roseate efflorescences glowed faintly like distant galaxies.
Where does Quetzalcoatl come into all this? Bridget says he's a hybrid too.
The new gods were not sufficient. A matter as much of politics as power. The people longed for a god who would truly represent their interests and with whom they could identify. At the same time, friction increased steadily between the exiles and their allies. The outsiders sensed the balance of power slipping away from them and began to sense in Coatlicue and her brood tendencies similar to those within the Archon Directorate who had driven them forth in the first place. The gods wanted more than just paranormal powers. They wanted to rule. A compromise was struck, or so it was presented by Tezcatlipoca, who by then had often interposed himself as peacemaker between the exiles and his volatile sibling and mother. What was needed was nothing less than the incarnation of the life god, Quetzalcoatl. Moral, the exile leader, was himself an early specimen of what became baronial class hybrids. His abilities and nature were appropriate to that deity. It was agreed that he should assume the mantle and personality pattern of the feathered serpent. He underwent the same process to which you were subjected, involving, among other things, stimulation of the pineal gland with converging beams of slow neutrons in order to stimulate certain faculties latent within the human and hybrid brain. It is not a protracted procedure, but takes hours to recover from, during which time the subject is unconscious. Tezcatlipoca had laid a clever plan. While Moral was indisposed, the gods struck. They seized total control of Tenochtitlan and the surrounding valley. The exiles who resisted were killed out of hand, the rest secured under guard. All except Daraul, who was seen on the plot. When Moral awakened, he was presented with a fait accompli. He was offered the choice to join a triumvirate as co-ruler of the valley and the gods themselves, or see his remaining comrades sacrificed to Huitzilopochtli and Tezcatlipoca. The plumed serpent saw no choice but to accept the devil's bargain. He did what he could to contain the lust for blood power of Coatlicue, her sons and their followers. Then, about 30 years ago, the brother gods, who had long since become deadly rivals themselves, combined against him, toppled him, and drove him out. Since then, the only thing that has grown faster than their power has been their greed for more, and for blood, and prana. And now you know the story of how hybrids once dreamed they could live in harmony with humans, and were twice betrayed by humans and hybrids working in concert. So I suppose in the end they proved their point, didn't they?
The foreigners sat or stood in silence for a few moments while the story sank in.
I only have one question. If you don't want to answer it, don't.
I will try my best.
How do you come into the picture? The hybrid supremacist types we've got back home don't much object to using darker-skinned folks as servants. After all, we're all just livestock to them. But when it comes to breeding themselves, they always seem to work on the principle that white is right.
The exiled hybrids harbored comparatively little prejudice against humanity in general. That may account for a lack of more specific forms of racism.
Lady Chalchi Whitlikwe is correct that the exiles tried to free themselves from prejudice in all its forms. But that benign impulse isn't where I spring from. Among the hybrids who fled El Norte was a woman named Tiana. She too was a prototype of what became the Barons. She was exceptionally human in appearance, and likewise exceptionally attractive to pure humans, or so it would appear, since it pleased the god of the smoking mirror to seduce her. But the breeding plan that produced her was not entirely successful. Her hips and birth canal could not accommodate the size of a half-human child. She died in childbirth. My childbirth. I am the daughter of Tezcatlipoca, Lord of Hell.
Cain paced his bedchamber. Despite, or perhaps because of, his status as a god, the room was austere. A bed, a table, a lamp. Doors led to a small closet and bathroom with shower. He passed out here at night, unless the terrible weariness overcame him somewhere else, and he woke here in the morning, but he doubted that he actually slept here. Brigid told him that when he drew her to him through quantum space, she had arrived in some kind of clinic beside a sealed cylinder. She believed he had been inside, and perhaps he was returned there after passing out each night. Tonight, he was filled with strange, uncomfortable energy. The day's battle had brought unpleasant revelations about what he was, or what he was becoming. Nor was Teresa's tale exactly soothing. It proved how much more was going on, and not just here in the Valley of Mexico. Events about which he had no clue, layers beneath layers, with no hope of getting to the bottom of it all. Eventually, he threw himself down upon the thin mattress. What came over him was more like a delirium-laced drowse than true sleep. And then she came to him. At first, he thought she was a dream, a beautiful young woman, black hair hanging heavy and straight past her shoulders, clad in a gown of sheer white fabric that accented as much as it concealed of her ripe form. Wearily, he sat up and swung his legs over the side of the bed. He was almost as surprised to find himself still in his room as he was to see her.
Who are you?
She spoke the ancient tongue of the valley, at once alien and familiar. She smiled. Her lips were wide and full, her cheekbones high. Her eyes were almonds, little white showing to either side of black discs. She tipped her head back and let the gown drop from her broad shoulders. She was nude beneath, but he'd figured that out already. Her breasts were large and heavy. The nipples were broad and dark. Her pubic hair was a dense jungle. She held wide her arms, inviting.
What's the angle?
Do you not want me, Lord Tenatu?
To his chagrin, he found he did. He was glad a fold of the thin gray blanket had moved with him and now hung across his lap. He usually slept naked. His response was so immediate and emphatic that he wondered if it was more his demon rider's reaction than his own. or if it had something to do with the strange electricity that had seemed to tingle in his nerves since he had killed those men in hand-to-hand combat that day. Not knowing made him feel vulnerable. Still, he smiled lopsidedly.
So my hosts see fit to reward my efforts on their behalf? About damn time.
He stood. The blanket fell away. She waited. Her lips parted. He reached for her. From the communicator on his nightstand, Bridget's voice spoke.
Kane, don't touch her! She's deaf!
Bridget sat perched on her own bed, sipping chocolate. It came in two flavors here, alkali bitter or as sweet as week-old death. She was opting for sweet. Either brand carried a jolt of caffeine guaranteed to make your heart start beating after it had been cut in four pieces. She knew that even that wouldn't be enough when the nervous energy jag wore off and the dreadful lethargy overcame her. You'll die if you leave the valley. Their host's warning tolled like a carillon bell in her skull at such times, when she dangled between hyper and comatose. What had been done affected their metabolisms. Maroquin had admitted that much. There was a risk of literal burnout. Quetzalcoatl, once morale, now the chosen vessel of a god, was about to toss that god back in the pantheonic pot to await reincarnation, because for all his own healing powers, and the bastard science of Danann, Anunnaki, Archon, and Hybrid, and the mad genius god Tezcatlipoca, he was sick unto death and could not hold body and souls together much longer. Her hosts had assured them the treatment they had been given could be reversed. Bridget had her doubts. How exactly did you reverse bombarding the pineal gland with slow neutrons, bombing it with fast ones? Her bedside communicator spoke.
Lady Precious Green, you must get to your friend Kane's room at once. He is in great peril. I fear he has received a visitation by Chico Mecahuatl, the goddess whose embrace is certain death.
At Bridget's words, Kane rocked back.
Do not listen to her. She's only jealous. Come to me.
She reached to enfold him in her arms. He stepped back.
Not so fast. There's something about the prospect of sudden death that just makes it hard to keep a charge in the shock stick, if you catch my drift.
The sweetest mystery awaits.
That's what I'm afraid of, lady.
Suddenly, she was a woman of middle years, her hair a tangle, stocky but not altogether unattractive. She leaped back, and a disc of intolerable yellow brilliance blazed abruptly in her hand. He felt the heat of it 3 yards away, so intense he smelled the bedclothes begin to smolder.
Then die!
She threw the flaming disc at his throat. He caught it in his right hand. It grew brighter, glowed with intolerable fury. The bedclothes caught fire behind him. The awful radiance dimmed, went out. The flame streamed toward Kane's bare legs as if sucked by sudden vacuum and vanished. Then his hand was clamped on nothing. The fingers were intact, the skin unburned.
You're Chico Mecahuatl, Seven Snakes. They told me about you. One of your aspects is that of a mother with the sun for a shield. How smart was that, sending an assassin with a solar shield to slay the sun god?
He raised his arms, and then his whole body blazed forth with a terrible brilliance, brighter than the sun disk she had hurled at him. She threw up her arms before her face and changed again. A little girl stood there, dressed in a white smock and looking scared, clutching a flower in her hand.
Please, mister, I'm just a little girl. I wouldn't hurt you. I was only joking.
The light that shone from Kane's body dwindled, went out. He lowered his arms. He felt disoriented, foolish.
I couldn't hurt anybody. I'm frightened, mister. Please hold me.
She held out her arms again. The little girl spun to face the opening door. Bridget stood there, tall and terrible, with a look in her green eyes Kane had never seen there before. The child Chico Mecahuatl looked Bridget in the eyes, then stiffened and fell dead.
Baptiste, what the hell do you think you're doing?
Still staring intently at the now lifeless child's body sprawled upon the floor, Bridget held up an imperious hand. The outlines of the child's body blurred, changed. The woman Kane had first seen lay there now, naked, beautiful, and still dead.
You men, You're so easy.
Dr. Marroquin supervised as technicians in pastel lab coats collected the late maize goddess and trundled her off on a gurney. Teresa turned up briefly, too, wrapped in a red silk housecoat, but only cast Kane a hot-eyed cryptic glance and turned away.
Mighty fortuitous how you happened to know I had a nocturnal visitor, Doc. Not to mention who she was.
Not fortuitous at all, Lord Tenatio, but rather a bit of 20th century technology. I had a fiber-optic video pickup embedded in a corner of the wall.
You bugged my room? A god's own private sleeping chamber?
It eliminates a good deal of guesswork, don't you think?
Marroquin seemed totally unfazed by Kane's vehemence. Kane thought about giving him a quick hot foot, but dismissed it. He wouldn't give the sneaky little shit the satisfaction.
Besides, we require it so that we know when you're going to sleep and may commence your life support treatment. It is essential to your survival. Although we make it as painless and unobtrusive as we can.
But how did she get in here?
I'm not sure yet. We will conduct an investigation and attempt to tighten our security. But who can foresee results? Chico Mecahuatl was a shape-changer, as you both can attest. In all events, we must all be on our guard from this point on.
A burst of 9mm slugs chewed yellow dust out of the corner of the building as Grant ducked back. Domi crouched atop a trash bin, nude body glistening in the sun that filtered down through thin overcast like a fetish carved from black volcanic glass.
Why don't you just use your plasma rifle and fry their asses once and for all?
In answer, Grant ducked down, then whipped around the corner, just his shooting arm and half his face, to fire two quick tri-bursts. Then he snapped back into cover as a fresh, furious volley replied.
Two more down. I hate to waste jewels on pissants like this. With all these gods and goddesses and monsters on the loose, you never know when you're gonna need a lot of plasma in a hell of a hurry.
Superficially plausible, but bullshit. You like the challenge.
Where'd you learn to talk like that?
I don't know. Maybe Bridget, maybe Lakesh, maybe even the obsidian Flutterby. Hey!
An especially bold Eagle Knight dodged sideways into view, an MP5 held at waist level. Grant knocked the blaster's barrel up as the man triggered an ear-splitting burst. Domi sprang. As she flew past the knight, now wrestling with Grant, she reached out a claw-tipped hand, hooked the flesh on the right side of his face, and used her hurtling body weight to yank his head around. His neck broke with a crack like a hand blaster shot. She landed on all fours in the middle of the street, facing a squad of Talokan sect men who had crept up in file behind the knight with their backs to the wall. They turned and fled. Domi bounced back under cover as some of their buddies down the block fired at her and missed.
Now who's showing off?
Yeah, to you too.
Let's move. We got things to see and people to do.
They checked cautiously down the street from which the attack had come. It was empty of enemies as far as they could see. They moved on, seeking more trouble to get into. Grant padded along on foot, acutely aware of the fact that although it was fairly cloudy, his shadow suit was anything but inconspicuous out here on a daylit street. Domi kept pace, leaping from ledge to cornice a story or two up like a naked ape. When no hand or footholds were offered, she made her own, sinking the needle claws on her fingers and the similar set on her toes into brick or stone or concrete as if it were tree bark. They heard nearby shooting. Here in this cubist jungle of the Colhuacan business district, deserted due to the battle in progress, sound generally echoed from unpredictable directions. Domi scampered ahead and peered around a corner from 20 feet up. Then she came back to where Grant waited and dropped lightly to the sidewalk beside him.
Our guy's in a firefight with a bunch of their guys.
Domi hitched at the shoulder rig harness that supported her Detonix hand blaster. It was the only thing she wore. She figured that as fast as she was, and an overtly lust-struck Ernesto had told her that her reflexes and twitch response musculature were faster than any deities yet measured, she still couldn't outrun bullets. She reasoned that none of the bad guys would be able to outrun them either, so the gun would be handy. In any event, she hadn't yet felt a need to shoot anybody. Then again, Grant thought, maybe she just enjoyed ripping people open and having their blood run all over her naked skin. The notion did little to lighten his mood.
Let's sneak around and jump the bad guys from behind.
It's what we're here to do.
In spite of himself, his eyes trailed down her body.
Girl, sometimes I worry about you.
What?
Grant gestured half-heartedly, a rare thing in itself for him to do anything without total commitment. Her pubic hair was shaved into a stylized skull. It wasn't especially visible, but Grant was all too aware it was there.
What's wrong with that? Just trying to blend in with the local culture. The least I can do. I am one of their goddesses, you know.
This is all too strange for me. I thought I'd seen strange before, running with this bunch. But this all is really weird.
Shh! Listen!
The radio blared. In the command center, on the roof of the Agricultural Products Distribution Combine building in Midtown Colhuacan.
The gods Tlaloc and Chipe Totec, come, riding the thunder. You must aid us, Lord Tonatiuh. Please.
One arrow pulled off an earpiece he'd had pressed to the side of his head. He was an intel officer detached from Don Exildo's staff.
It is a general assault. A mixed force of Sekhmin and Knights. They're hitting us at the Parque Vicente Fernandez.
How far?
Just under a click, Lady Chalchi Huitlicue.
She looked at Kane.
I guess here's where we earn the big bucks.
Two men danced past Grant and Domi down the street, each intent upon strangling the other. One was laughing wildly, his lips skinned so far back from his teeth blood started from his gums. The other's eyes wept blood. A knight of the blue macaw staggered toward them. His helmet was gone, his topknot disarrayed, his eyes bloody roadmaps. As he neared Grant and Domi, he raised his right hand to his temple and fired his laser armlet. His head exploded in a cloud of black steam. The body took three steps more toward Grant and Domi, fountaining blood with each of the heart's last convulsive beats. The spray ebbed, dwindled. The corpse fell almost at their feet.
This is bad.
Grant checked the magazine on his sin-eater to make sure it was full. Then he checked to be sure he had a round chambered. Around the corner strode a figure. It was tall and clad in a cape of green feathers. On its feet were stone clogs 4 inches high. Its head was covered by a box perhaps a foot square. It looked to be made of wood or stiff fabric stretched on some kind of frame of an off-white parchment color. On it were painted various highly stylized figures, serpents, bats, distorted human figures, the ubiquitous skulls, all in different colors. Its very gaudiness was somehow sinister. Grant had no idea how the thing could see. There were no eye holes on the box for it to see through. The being stopped and regarded them with hands on hips.
Ah, outlanders.
Grant sensed it just meant foreigners, without the connotations the word had up north. But then, who knew in this fused-out place?
It's Mika Petlakali. Careful with this one, Grant.
A squad of Sekh men with long blasters at port arms trotted out of the alley behind the bizarre apparition.
Got him scoped. You go play with those boys.
Done.
The tall figure had continued to move toward Grant, balancing on his tall clogs. Despite them, he moved with sinuous, sinister grace.
I am called Mika Petlakali. Look now into my box of death.
He reached up almost delicately and swung open the front of the box. But Grant didn't look. He didn't need to. The man was inside 7 yards now, classic combat hand blaster range. After Grant's decades of practice and experience, putting his body into two-handed shooting stance was so automatic, he didn't need to see his front sight to know the muzzle of his sin-eater in its perforated shroud was aimed right into the opening.
I'm called Grant. Open wide.
Out in the park, blasters were crackling and grens thumping as the two sides slugged it out in a conventional firefight. The Parque Vicente Fernandez was huge, half a click across here where they faced the attackers coming from the east, half a click deep, narrowing slightly in a vague wedge shape toward the broad promenade fronting the local eruption of Texcoco on the Quetzalcoatl force's right. Kane, Bridget, and an escort of knights crouched inside the blown-in window of a bistro fronting the park, staying mindful of the broken glass. Firebird, ranking survivor of yesterday's bodyguard, filled the gods in quickly on the tactical situation. Originally, the good guys held the whole park. 15 minutes ago, a large force spearheaded by at least two of Talokan's most powerful, the Flayed One and the Rain God, had smashed them hard and sent them reeling. The defenders had managed to rally and hold around the concrete bandstand and a miniature lagoon just this side of the middle of the park, backed by shooters hidden in some woods. After butchering a few windrows of Sekhmen, the enemy gods had kept their own heads down. As Kane was well aware, the most potent god could be laid low by a stray energy beam, if not a bullet. They had achieved their initial aim, tossing down a challenge to the feathered serpent's interloper gods. Kane switched channels on his comm unit.
Grant, Domi, come in.
Yeehaw! Grant just killed a god! A whole god! By himself!
Kane winced at the sudden onslaught of Domi's voice in his ear.
He's just the man to do it. You there, Grant?
I'm here.
You sound sour. DSI doesn't agree with you?
It was a fusee with a friggin' box on his head, Kane. Whoop-de-doo.
It was Mika Petlakali! Maybe not the biggest or baddest, but he had only just zeroed out a whole platoon of knights and secmen by his lonesome is all. If you saw his face, you'd self-chill, or your brain would blow up, and you'd bleed out your ears and eyes.
Hence the box, I guess.
Not much of his ugly mug left now, after I dumped half a mag into it.
Good job. Looks like we're about to mix it up with a couple of the biggies.
All right, we're there!
Back off the trigger, butterfly. Don't you two charge over here. What I need you to do is circle around east, swinging well north of the lake. See if you can work in behind them.
Spoil sport!
Negative. If you bring it off, you're on their backs with them looking this way. Then you can murder them all you like.
Are you hosing us, Kane?
Big time. But you know this really is the best way, Grant.
I hear you.
Yeah, but will you play it my way?
Affirmative. So will the Iron Butterfly, or whatever the hell she is. Grant out.
A line of yellow-white radiance, bright as 1,000 searchlights, jagged down from the clouds. A whole squad of Sekmen duck-walking toward the gazebo screamed as their bodies abruptly went incandescent and the hair stood out from their heads and took fire. Then the lightning bolt winked out, leaving huge purple afterimage balloons swimming in Kane's dazzled eyes and charred bodies smoking on the ground. Ducked down below the sill, Bridget looked up at Kane. Her face was greenish pale, but her strong jaw was firm.
I think they know we're here.
Right. You men skirmish forward toward the middle of the park. I'm right behind you. And Bridget, you're right behind me.
Like hell I am. I'm sticking right at your side.
Like hell you are.
Kane held up his left arm. His buckler blazed into a disc of yellow brilliance.
Unless the rain shorts it out, the solar shield will cover both of us.
The knights charged out, screaming war cries and firing bolts and beams. Bridget fell in behind Kane's left shoulder as he clambered out to follow the warriors out into the park. Their guard advanced by fire and movement fits and starts. Most of the action was far out front, but the occasional bullet cracked past. Kane thanked the gods, or the Tenochtitlan City Fathers, same thing come to think of it, for the abundance of solid concrete park benches. Not that it befit the dignity of the sun god, Tonatiuh, to cower behind cover, but just in case. The solar shield was all well and good, but it only sheltered so much. The air was thick with the smell of rain and tart with ozone, and the barbecue smell of seared flesh. Burn propellant and lubricant had begun to add their bouquet to the mix. White sparks danced in the glare circle of the solar shield.
Kane, what the hell is that?
Bullets.
They were taking fire from a garden patch several hundred yards away to the left, planted with shoulder-high but great-leaved plants. Excellent concealment, but no cover, no capacity to stop return fire, to speak of. Kane pointed the spot out to his escort. Several knights went prone or took a knee and fired. Laser beams and a plasma blast flared in the gloom, shockingly bright. Though he heard screams as the beams hit flesh, or as steam flash-boiled from the lush vegetation scalded enemy fighters, Kane had lost interest. That problem was tended to. He was into Tonatiuh mode now, looking for worthy opposition. Chipe or Tlaloc. Am I crazy? Wondered the Kane, who was still all Kane. But it was a cry from the cheap seats. Suddenly, some of Kane's men were running toward them from the middle of the park.
This is it. Let's shake it loose.
You sure this is a good idea?
No.
They trotted toward the gazebo. The fleeing men threw away their blasters and started screaming and clawing at themselves. One of the knights approached the advancing group at a wild, sprawling run, then collapsed, tumbled, and lay still on the damp, thick grass. Kane paused to crouch beside the man, dead. He looked burned, but with no charring. The skin on his head was discolored, bubbled in places, peeled back away from yellow bone in others. The eyelids were puffed shut with a foam reminiscent of salted slugs oozing out between.
What did this? Some kind of radiation?
I think it's gas. It looks like characteristic effects of an extremely powerful blistering agent.
Blistering agent?
Like mustard gas. I'm not pretending to be a tactician, but if that's what Chipe's power amounts to, it doesn't seem too smart pairing him with the rain god. Rain cancels out most aerosol agents.
Maybe the Talakan gods are only too human, like us.
Kane and Bridget looked into the gazebo. A figure had appeared there. It was the size and shape of a tall, athletically proportioned man, but it was red. Not like any kind of skin, but the red of an open wound. It wore a strange, shriveled-looking cape about its wide shoulders.
Chipe Totec appears in the guise of a flayed man wearing his own skin upon his shoulders.
Oh, that's really lovely, Baptiste.
Their escorts pointed blasters at the figure. They seemed reluctant to fire on the person of a god, even an enemy god who had just subjected a number of their comrades to horrible death. Kolwa Khan Sekhmen fled at the sight of the being. In his right hand, Chipe held a mace with what appeared to be a round stone head. On his left forearm was strapped a circular shield like Kane's. He reached his arms out to the side and raised them. Even at this range, Kane and Bridget could see that his ribs seemed to open outward like louvers or the breathing slits of a shark. A maroon-colored gas issued from his sides.
All right. How does he do that?
Perhaps poison sacs inside the ribcage. Except how is that possible if his aspect is just a Danann shape-changing illusion? This is really incredible. If only we could study what's actually going on here.
I'll try to bag him so Lakesh can study him. Marakin probably has all the answers already, if he'd give them to you straight.
Kane turned to order the Knights of the Blue Macaw.
Watch Lady Precious Green and discourage any mortals who try to interfere. This one's mine.
He aimed his sword and summoned the power of the sun. The glowing arcs seemed uncharacteristically dim and weak, but they were there. A lance of plasma sizzled toward the flayed god, who sidestepped. The blast shattered a pillar of the gazebo, causing part of the roof to sag.
Kane, lightning!
He smelled ozone. Hairs stood at his nape. With his own enhanced reaction time and speed, he darted to Bridget and held his shield up over their heads, summoning the sun's power to defend them.
Wouldn't plasma be more a conductor than an insulator?
We're about to find out.
The world whited out around them. Kane felt as if a sledgehammer had struck his shield arm. The impact drove him to one knee. Bridget, who carried no shield or weapons other than the Glock strapped under her arm, helped brace him. Within Kane's brain, whiteness and blackness warred. Overload, he thought. With sudden insight, he forced himself to concentrate on channeling the horrific energy surge into the fiery arcs that sprang out through the surface of the Earth from his very innards and twined around them both like solar prominences. The question was whether he could shunt the lightning bolt safely around them as they huddled beneath the shield, frail despite the prana powers with which they had been imbued. It worked. They lived. Kane stretched his length upon the ground as the terrific blinding whiteness winked out. He was whirled away into blackness. Before he gave himself up to it totally, he heard a voice within him.
Well done, mortal. Not even I knew that could be done.
Like a scalded cat, Domi jumped to the top of an outsized block of yellow stone that made up one flank of the broad staircase of what looked like a public building of some sort, maybe a library or museum. She crouched there, her glassy skin quivering.
Gah! Bugs!
Mm-hmm.
Grant was still planted firmly on the street. Domi wasn't squeamish. It was the rare outlander who survived to adulthood if she was. Pressed by hunger, she would eat bugs as well as other items that made even Grant queasy. But there were bugs, and then there were bugs. As in, a mad profusion of the things, thousands and tens of thousands, a living river flowing toward them across a broad street and over curbs and planters. It reached Grant. He could feel the big beetles and scorpions and foot-long millipedes crawl across his shadow-suited feet. Not exactly a pleasant sensation, but these small, creepy crawlies, venomous though some of them no doubt were, couldn't bite through the armor, woven as it was of spider silk, monochrist, and spectra fabrics.
Grant, jump from my hand, now!
What do I care about a bunch of...
Jump or die!
It wasn't that Domi didn't have it in her to fuck around, but not when the hammer came down. Without further thought, he leaped.
Wait a minute. You can't... Whoa! Lift me.
Domi had straightened, yanking him up and setting him on his feet atop the block.
Enhanced musculoskeletal efficiency. Comes with divinity.
Why'd you want me up here so bad?
She inclined her head. The arthropods had been joined by rattlesnakes, sidewinders, diamondbacks, and prairie rattlers. their needle-like fangs, an inch long and more, would have an easier job penetrating his shadow suit. And if they didn't, the stings of the 5-foot-long scorpions, all following the smaller creatures like a cresting vermin tsunami, assuredly would.